Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today on our Capital Report, we'll be talking about which local projects could be eligible for funding under the landmark infrastructure bill just signed into law by President Joe Biden. Plus, hear what's in the Build Back Better Act, just passed by the House of Representatives, and how your congressional members voted. Then, we'll have news of a suspect hospitalized after making a school threat in Ramona. And we'll tell you about a dramatic rescue of a coyote caught in a car bumper. Yes, you heard that right. And no roadrunners were spotted in the vicinity. Our newsmaker interview today is with Supervisor Joel Anderson. He'll be talking about his efforts to expand accessibility at local lakes and reservoirs, as well as his efforts to bring homeless shelters and services to unincorporated areas of the county. And on the second half of our show today, we'll be re-airing our bookshelf host Raina Menashe's interview with author Stephen McGinty on his book, The Dive, a true tale of the world's deepest submarine rescue, which included some local heroes right here in San Diego County. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. This is East County Magazine's Capital Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital. Could funds from the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act just signed into law by President Joe Biden be used to fund sorely needed projects to benefit East County, from wildfire prevention to reducing freeway gridlock, taking communities off-grid, or improving dam safety? In a statement sent to East County Magazine, Congresswoman Sarah Jacobs says, "We have big infrastructure needs in San Diego, from broadband to transportation to wildfire prevention. But the good news is that this bill provides new funding to meet these needs. Now it's time to make sure that San Diego gets our share of the funding, and I look forward to working with our state and local partners to get that done," she adds. The historic measure will create good jobs, connect our communities, strengthen our energy grid, and help us combat climate change, Jacobs says. The bill includes over $44 billion in formula funding for California, with much more money also available through grant programs. According to a White House fact sheet, under the formula funding alone, over the next 5 years, California is expected to receive more than $25 billion for federal aid highway programs, $4 billion for bridge replacements and repairs, $9 billion to improve public transportation options, $3.5 billion for water infrastructure to assure clean drinking water in communities, $1.5 billion for airport infrastructure, $384 million to expand an electric charging vehicle network, part of a nationwide network, $100 million to expand broadband coverage for high-speed internet access, especially in rural areas, $84 million to protect against wildfires, and $40 million to protect against cyber attacks. Now, according to the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, the San Diego metro area will be eligible for $849 million in Highway Trust Fund and General Fund funding over the next 5 years through this bill. These are two of the primary funds for roads and transit. The other parts of the bill will come out of other revenue streams. So, what about East County-specific projects? Congresswoman Jacobs, at a press conference in El Cajon shortly before the bill was signed, had this to say when asked by East County Magazine about certain highway projects in East County.
A lot of my readers are asking us what projects there might be for East County. I know you talked about the priorities for climate change projects and transit, but most all of that is in San Diego and coastal areas. For the road improvements part, is there any chance that they could get anything for finally, say, widening Highway 52 or doing safety improvements along 94 or 67?
So the specific projects that the infrastructure funding is going to haven't been identified yet. There will be some portion of the funding that is formula funding, and the county of San Diego and the region in general will get probably around $850 million for roads and bridges, and then there'll be a part that is competitive grant programs that local governments will have to apply for to be able to get that funding. funding. And so I'll be working closely with our local partners to make sure that we are getting as much funding as possible and that we're incorporating the community's voice in deciding which projects that's going to.
Very good. So it wouldn't be just Santa Ag or supervisors or someone making those decisions. It would be something where your office is involved in that as well, or how does that work?
That's right. We help advocate for our regional grants, applications and others to the Department of Transportation.
We asked Will McDonald, Communications Director for Congresswoman Jacobs, to respond to some other questions. Since the bill includes money for Superfund site cleanups, we asked if funds might be available to clean up the toxic plume near Gillespie Field and Magnolia Elementary School. McDonald replied in writing, "The toxic plume in El Cajon and the potential for contaminated air and water is very concerning. The legislation includes very significant funding for both environmental cleanup and clean water projects, and our office would look forward to meeting with local officials to discuss securing federal support. How about taking some backcountry communities that have suffered many preemptive power outages off-grid with solar to power an entire town like Descanso, just like Borrego Springs has already done?" McDonald says the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act includes over $60 billion in funding to upgrade electrical grids to help ensure reliable power delivery. So this, too, could be a possibility. Asked if funds could go toward transit and rail projects that Sandag wants and maybe avoid that mileage tax that Sandag wants everybody to pay, McDonald said many of the projects Sandag is working on would be eligible for funding under the bill, but he directed any specific questions on those projects to the Regional Planning Agency. "So what about widening the gridlocked Highway 52 and Santee?" McDonald replies, "Congresswoman Jacobs knows that congestion on Highway 52 has long been a concern in East County. Any specific programs and projects would need to first be authorized and planned by state and local governments. But a highway widening project like this would likely be eligible to apply for federal funding under the legislation." We asked about water quality improvements, and McDonald says there are still tens of thousands of lead pipes in use in California, and there has been increased concern about their prevalence in San Diego County in recent years. He adds, "The Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act provides $15 billion in funding to replace lead pipes and is a historic opportunity to make sure every school and home in the U.S. is free from lead pipes." East County Magazine also asked if infrastructure funds could be used to repair the dangerous El Capitan Dam in Lakeside. The earthen dam built in the 1930s has received a low safety rating of poor from the state and the worst possible rating for potential loss of life. Models have shown if it broke, it could flood all the way to Mission Valley and beyond, killing potentially thousands of people. The dam lies near the Elsinore earthquake fault, which is capable of more than a 7.0 quake, increasing the risk of potential catastrophe. McDonald confirms that the infrastructure bill does include money for dam maintenance and repairs. We also reached out to Supervisor Joel Anderson on this issue, who said it would be up to the City of San Diego to take the lead on asking for money for dam repairs, since the city owns and operates the dam, but that he could write a letter of support if Mayor Todd Gloria were to request funds to make the dams safer. So, folks, if you care about any of these infrastructure projects or others, it's a good idea to make your voices heard to your state and local elected officials, since they're the ones that will be putting in recommendations or applying for grants to fund any specific local projects. San Diego's four Democratic representatives voted in favor of the infrastructure bill, but Republican Daryl Issa voted against it. 13 Republicans who did vote for the measure in the House of Representatives have faced a backlash within their party for supporting Joe Biden's measure and have been threatened to face primary challengers. Congresswoman Sarah Jacobs says she was honored to represent San Diego at the White House signing of the infrastructure bill, adding, "The next step will be for our local, state, and federal officials to work together to make sure that East County receives the funding it needs." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
The Build Back Better Act has now passed the House and is on its way to the Senate. On the heels of a major infrastructure bill signed into law by President Joe Biden, on Friday, the House of Representatives passed the Build Back Better Act on a party line 220 to 213 vote, which now advances to the Senate. The landmark measure would expand the nation's social safety net for the middle class and poor, including increased child care, Medicare benefits, college aid, housing support, invest in shifting the nation to renewable energy, and more. The New York Times reports that even the pared-down $2.2 trillion measure could prove as transformative as any since the Great Society and War on Poverty in the 1960s, especially for young families and older Americans. What is in the bill includes large investments in renewable energy and electric vehicles to address climate change, plus tax incentives for low-emission energy sources, 4 weeks of paid family and medical leave for workers, universal preschool, child care subsidies and tax credits, including for the middle class, expanded financial aid for college, support for older Americans, including home and community support. Also, price controls to reduce prescription drug costs, reduced premiums for Affordable Care Act for 9 million Americans, allows 4 million uninsured people to become eligible for Medicaid coverage, expanded earned income tax credit for low-income workers, adds a hearing benefit for Medicare recipients, invests in affordable housing, and protection of Native American sacred lands at Oak Flat, Arizona, to prevent destructive copper mining. The measure would be funded largely through a surcharge ranging from 5% for people earning over $10 million or 8% for those earning over $25 million. It would also increase funds for the Internal Revenue Service to go after wealthy tax evaders, since 1% of earners are estimated to evade $160 billion in taxes a year, according to the White House. It would also provide modest tax increases on some larger corporations and provide incentives to keep jobs in the United States, among other provisions. Savings on prescription drugs by allowing Medicare to negotiate prescription drug prices is also expected to reap substantial savings to help fund the bill's programs. The Congressional Budget Office on Thursday estimated that the bill could increase the federal deficit by up to $160 billion over 10 years, though some dispute that figure based on disagreement over how much revenue would be raised through enhanced IRS enforcement on tax dodgers. Two of East County's congressional representatives voted in favor, while one voted against. Congressman Juan Vargas, a Democrat representing the southern portion of San Diego County, says the bill delivers transformational action for American families that would lower child care costs, establish universal paid family and medical leave, invest in clean energy to protect our climate, and extend the child tax credit. He added, "I am dedicated to fighting for immigration reform, a provision that would have provided a pathway to citizenship for undocumented immigrants was removed from the bill to comply with a complex reconciliation process that allows only items that have a direct fiscal impact, though language protects some immigrants who have resided in the U.S. for many years remains." Vargas indicated in a Twitter post, "I am dedicated to fighting for immigration reform and ask my colleagues in the Senate to keep the current protections in the bill and take them even further to create a pathway to citizenship." Congresswoman Sarah Jacobs, a Democrat representing portions of East County and San Diego, praised tax cuts for working families, lower cost of health care premiums and prescription drugs, and getting Americans back to work that she anticipates will happen if the bill becomes law. She also tweeted on Friday, "I made it a priority to ensure the Build Back Better Act addressed our child care crisis, and today I voted to cut the cost of child care in half for millions and to give 35 million American families a tax cut through the expanded child tax credit." She added, "We did it." But Congressman Daryl Issa, a Republican whose district includes rural and conservative portions of East County, issued a statement voicing his view that the bill won't build anything better. He faulted the measure for giving billions to Green New Deal activists at a time of skyrocketing inflation and diminishing economic opportunity. Issa also opposed efforts to provide amnesty for some undocumented immigrants and claimed Democrats aren't interested in easing the high tax burden on tens of millions of Americans. He also faulted the measure for increasing funds for the IRS to collect unpaid taxes and criticized drafting of the bill behind closed doors. The bill is expected to face a tougher time and likely undergo more changes in the narrowly divided Senate, where Democrats have exactly half the votes, with Vice President Kamala Harris the potential tie-breaking vote. But at least two moderate Democrats, Joe Manchin of Kentucky and Kristen Sinema of Arizona, have yet to state how they will vote. Any changes would require the Build Back Better bill, if passed by the Senate, to go back to the House for a reconciliation vote before it could advance to President Joe Biden for signature. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Marie Johnson.
A 15-year-old boy is being cared for at a hospital as a safety precaution after threatening to hurt students and staff at Ramona High School, according to Lieutenant Daniel Vengler with the San Diego Sheriff's Department. Deputies with the Ramona Sheriff Substation responded to the campus Thursday morning, November 18th, after receiving a call from the assistant principal. The 15-year-old boy alluded to bringing a gun to school and told his friend not to come to school on Thursday or Friday. The student who was informed about the threat then alerted school staff. The student who made the threats was found by deputies at a donut shop, where he told deputies the threat was, quote, a careless thing to say. Deputies searched his home and did not find any guns or other means to carry out the threat he made, says Lieutenant Vengler, adding, there is no immediate threat to public safety. Classes resumed on Friday, November 19th, without incident. Tony Newman, principal at Ramona High School, posted on the school's website that he had confidence that the school would provide a safe learning environment for all students and staff. The Sheriff's Department urges students who hear threats of potential violence to contact a school resource deputy or call the anonymous Student Speaking Out hotline at 888-580-8477. If you or someone you know is experiencing a crisis, help is available. Trained counselors are available 24 hours per day to offer confidential counseling and other services. Call 888-724-7240. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Elijah McKee.
A not-so-wily coyote has been rescued from inside a car bumper where it became trapped after being struck by a motorist. Though this may sound like a plot from a popular TV cartoon, no Roadrunners or Acme products were reported in the vicinity. Fortunately, the older female coyote is now back in the wild after treatment at the San Diego Humane Society's Ramona Wildlife Center. This amazing rescue was documented on video on November 1st when San Diego Humane Society's Humane Law Enforcement Team was dispatched to rescue an animal lodged in the bumper of a car in a San Marcos parking lot. The person who hit the coyote did not realize that she was stuck in his bumper and was inside a Ralph's grocery store when another shopper noted a dog in the bumper and called for help. The car's owner was alerted to the situation when he came out of the Ralph's. Humane officers were startled to learn that the dog was, in fact, a wild coyote. They called San Diego Humane Society's veterinary team to the scene to help monitor the coyote's well-being as she was cut out from inside the fender. Upon arrival at the Ramona Wildlife Center, the coyote could stand and walk. The veterinary team performed exams and x-rays to ensure that there were no fractures or internal bleeding. The coyote's teeth revealed her age as a senior, but according to Christine Barton, Director of Operations and Wildlife Rehab at the Humane Society's Ramona campus, the coyote was in wonderful condition for her age with a healthy weight and coat. The coyote spent 18 days at the Ramona Center receiving treatment for shock and a severely injured paw pad. Project Wildlife's medical team treated her with fluids, pain medication, and kept her under close observation as she recovered. The coyote was released in the late afternoon of November 18th in a park near the San Marcos location where she was found. Barton says, "We are so happy she recovered quickly and could be returned to her natural habitat." San Diego Humane Society's Project Wildlife program is a primary resource for wild animal rehabilitation and conservation education in San Diego County. Each year, SDHS gives a second chance to more than 13,000 injured, orphaned, and sick wild animals. The new Ramona campus opened in 2020 and specializes in caring for native apex predators and birds of prey, including hawks, owls, eagles, coyotes, bears, bobcats, and mountain lions. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Marie Johnson.
You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for our region.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with East County Magazine and the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ. And I am delighted today to introduce our special guest, Supervisor Joel Anderson. Joel, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Miriam. It's a pleasure.
Well, I understand congratulations are in order for the vote that you got approved by the county supervisors today. That's a step toward helping keep parks around our local lakes and reservoirs open. Tell us about the vote today.
Well, during the pandemic, we saw the city of San Diego only opened three of the lakes that they control, the recreational use of those lakes. And these are reservoirs primarily in East County. And yet we know that hunting, fishing, boating, hiking, camping are all family activities that are COVID approved, where nobody goes in a group of folks to fish. They usually want to hide their favorite fishing hole. And it's the same thing when you're boating. If you get too close, you bump boats. So these are great COVID approved recreational activities for families and individuals. So during that campaign, we collected over 1,200 letters of support, put pressure on the county, and forced the county to work with the city to open the reservoirs, like at El Cap, at Barrett Lake, all these places that East County residents love to attend.
I've got the list here. Let me just read them so listeners and viewers here will know. This includes viewers, because we're also going to air the podcast on our news site. El Capitan Reservoir, Upper Otay Reservoir, San Vicente, Lake Hodges, Sutherland, and Barrett Reservoirs. So six of them all together, I understand. Did I miss any?
Yes, that's correct. I think Hodges is one too, but in Lake Murray. But the key, though, is why do we have to wait till the next pandemic? The county right. should be working with the city. We have a parks department. It's our residents. It's my constituents who frequently use these locations, and they're a wonderful place to take your family. So I want to fulfill my campaign promise in the first year.
Super. So my understanding is that the city, in response to what you did during the campaign, your campaign, they reopened them temporarily, but only for a limited number of days a week at some of these. So as I understand it, your proposal to the supervisors today, which was backed up by another signature with about at least 750 signatories, would be for county staff to reach out to the city of San Diego and some other agencies, Sweetwater Authority, I think there was one other.
Right, Helix Water District, all these folks that control recreational use to ensure that we can keep them open for our residents.
Right. So if the city of San Diego, for example, which owns most of these or runs most of them, couldn't or wouldn't, do you foresee that the county might step in and help?
Oh, absolutely.
A bit on the
we want to partner with them. The city of San Diego, their residents also use it. These are regional resources throughout the county. So, of course, we want to, I think the key is making sure that we give the most options for people who enjoy being outdoors and doing it in a safe way. I mean, this is the beauty of all this. Is it's COVID approved, right? So
great idea.
Whether
you
have a mask or not, you're in a boat alone. Exactly. You're pretty doggone safe outside.
Yeah, there's probably nothing you can do that's safer than going boating or fishing out there at one of these lakes or hiking on one of these remote trails. Better than going to a crowded beach or a bar in the gas lamp.
Absolutely, and look, that's what makes East County a jewel to the county that we have these resources.
True,
that's a good thing.
No, we're sort of the playground, the backcountry playground for all of San Diego, really. And a lot of people just don't realize that. Now, I'm curious, Joel, do you see opportunities for the county to make improvements maybe at some of the other reservoirs that might also generate revenue to help pay for, you know, the added cost of this? Like at Lake Morena, for example, the county has cabins. I've seen some other lakes where they put up everything from teepees to canoe rentals to, you know, you name it, to help enhance the recreational opportunities, number one, but also make programs self-sustaining.
Well, Miriam, that's an excellent suggestion, but it's baby steps, right? So first, let's start and establish a relationship, and then let's grow from that. But that's what I'm hoping. I'm hoping down the road that not only do we have 24/7 access to these lakes, access to these activities, but we can enhance the activities to serve more people and more interests.
Yeah, great idea. Yeah, I'm thinking of Helix a few years ago. They were ready to permanently close down the campgrounds and things at Lake Jennings. And there was one board director, Joel Scalzitti, who said, no, no, give me a year to make it profitable. And they figured out ways to do that so that they got into the black again.
Padre Dam with the lakes there. Mm-hmm. Those lakes, they have cabins, they have all sorts of stuff, and people love it. You know, it's you're in the city, but you feel like you're in the country.
Yeah, you can do, you know, bicycles built for four Surreys they had for a while, a little spray park for the little kids, and yeah, all kinds of stuff that was really, really fun there, pedal boats. I wanted to bring another lake-related, reservoir-related issue to your attention, Joel, but we've been doing some research here with the infrastructure bill that's coming down the road that the federal government just approved, that President Biden just signed. And in checking with our Congresswoman, Sarah Jacobs, she informed me that it does include the potential to fund dam repairs. And I don't know if you're aware, but as of 2021, this year, the state has ranked two dams in San Diego County poor quality, the most dangerous possible. They are Lake, the El Capitan Reservoir and the Lake Hodges Reservoir. And they're also rated the highest, meaning the worst possible danger in terms of the inundation, the amount of lives that would be lost were they to break, which just seems like a disaster waiting to happen. And I'm particularly concerned about El Capitan because it's so near the Elsinore Fault that has the potential for high 7-point quake. To occur within the next, I think it's 50 or 100 years. Were that dam to break or rupture, you would have lives potentially lost. I mean, the flood zone includes where the new SDSU campus is being built in Mission Valley, which just seems, really dangerous. But is that something where you might consider, I guess it's ultimately up to the county to recommend to the feds which infrastructure projects they want to see funded? While everybody's talking about should it be transit or should it be freeways, there's this dam sitting there that is really dangerous.
The city of San Diego has its own pot of money. Mm-hmm. In fact, I believe it has as much or more than the county.
Interesting.
And have you had a chance to talk to Mayor Todd Gloria? Because those dams are under his control.
No, that's a good idea.
They're not county controlled.
Okay, I will definitely reach out to them.
Yeah, and I'm reluctant to get out ahead. I'd rather have their answer. If they needed help with like a letter of support, mm-hmm. I'd be happy to send a letter of support. But you know what? I'm very careful about staying in my lane and not telling them other people how to run their business.
Yeah, no, I understand. But obviously the lives at stake include folks in your district, the folks that live in El Monte Valley, for example, that only has one way in and one way out.
Sure, sure. Yeah.
Okay, well, I will reach out to Mayor Gloria. So as far as your proposal that was approved today, how long does staff have to come back to you for a recommendation?
180 days, I could come back with a plan. And I'm hoping when they reach out to them, this is a simple low-lying fruit. I think that San Diego's never had a partner before. Mm-hmm. I think that they're going to be very open to the idea of having a partnership.
Part of the reason
why they didn't open all of the lakes is because they felt most of the residents didn't use some of the lakes that were further east. And yet we know people in District 2 use it all the time.
Oh, absolutely. So, they're beautiful resources out there. I've been to nearly all of them and they're great. So I think I can say thanks from everybody out here in East County to fighting to get those back open for the enjoyment of everyone. I'm going to let you have the final word today, but is there anything else that you would like to add that I didn't already ask you about?
Well, Miriam, I appreciate the interview. You know, I worked really hard to earn this office, and I plan to keep every one of my campaign promises. So two down and a few more to go. So as we move forward next year, I'll have more, I don't know if you know it, but we're moving forward addressing the homeless. I have a few board letters on that, on mental health that I promised on. We are moving forward, partnering with El Cajon and Santee to get some hubs and facilities built. So I'm moving ahead. I'm keeping my word. And I
very good.
I worked hard to move the SVPs as well. So
Yes, you did.
I'm appreciative for the honor of serving, and I love my job, and I want to do right by the people I represent.
Yeah. Well, let's take just a minute to talk a little bit more about the homeless stuff and what you've done there. I understand there was a proposal where you got it approved again for them to look at building shelters with services in the unincorporated areas in East County as well as North County, you know, for one of the supervisors from up
right
that way. What's going on with that? And how do we make sure that we get them out here?
Staff is out with it. They're going to come back with a proposal. Mm-hmm. I don't actually tell them what to do. I tell them what I want to accomplish. And then they come back as experts with a plan. And then we choose the plan that works best for us. But some of the items that we did are low-lying fruit. Is we have a real issue with safe parking.
Yes.
You know, some people unfortunately live in their cars, mm-hmm. and they need to know that when they park at night, that they're going to be safe. They're going to have bathroom services. Right. So that was one of the board letters, is to look at that along with tiny housing and some other out of the box thinking. Mm-hmm. But we don't have any of these resources right now in East County. And I think that we deserve to have the same resources as City of San Diego or North County or South Bay. And
well,
so I'm working feverishly to catch up and make sure that people don't slip through the cracks, that we take care of all of our neighbors.
Yeah, for such a long time, the City of El Cajon has really been the only one in East County that's had
they've done
resources to do
it.
Yeah, they're doing a lot. But you look at
now
Little
we're
Lemon Grove.
Some mental health components from the county to El Cajon to help step up their game.
Yeah, no, that's
so that we have better services.
Fantastically important. Little cities like La Mesa and Lemon Grove, they don't have the resources to go build their own shelters. And I've always wondered, why doesn't the county? So many of the homeless are camped along our rivers in Lakeside, in Santee,
right.
in Spring Valley, for example. And it's, of course, not only very sad to see people living that way, you know, the people that are in need that are homeless, but also it presents hazards such as fire dangers. There's been some fires that were started just by people trying to, you know,
and
stay warm or smoking.
Hepatitis and other illnesses.
Right,
so,
right.
You know what? Look, if we saw an animal living that way, we would rescue them. I believe
Good
we should
point.
Be rescuing all our neighbors and friends and making sure that nobody everyone should have an option not to live that way. And we need to give them those options. So, you know, I apologize. It's 1:15. I've got to zip out.
I know you do.
Accommodating my schedule.
You're very welcome.
Your cat is delightful. What's your cat's name?
Rex.
Rex.
Well, Rex. Yeah.
Rex is fully entertaining.
Thank you, Joel. All right. We've been speaking with Supervisor Joel Anderson, representing the vast 2nd District out here in East County, the unincorporated areas. Thank you so much for taking the time to join
Thank
us
you.
Today. Okay.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for our region.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment.
Today I'm speaking with author Stephen McGinty, author of the new book, The Dive, The Untold Story of the World's Deepest Submarine Rescue. My guest is also an award-winning journalist and producer of documentaries. His documentary, Fire in the Night, is based on the book of the same name and won the Audience Award at the Edinburgh International Film Festival and won Best Single Documentary. Stephen McGinty lives in Scotland. Welcome, Stephen. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
No, thank you for inviting me.
Let's begin with the story itself, the race against time that took place first to locate the Pisces 3 and then execute the deepest rescue in maritime history. What first sparked your interest in the topic and why write a book?
Well, I first heard about it when I was on a cruise, of all things, many years ago. I was on a cruise and I was sitting at the captain's table and he told me the story that of this incredible sequence of events that had taken place just off the coast of Ireland, well, about 150 miles off the coast of Ireland back in 1973. And I'd always been fascinated by the deep. I'd always been fascinated by oceans. And I filed it away. And I was amazed that no one had actually done told a modern story about it, written a modern book. And I was looking for a new subject for a book and decided to dust it down as an idea. And when I looked at it, it's just the most incredible story. I mean, my goal was to write a nonfiction thriller, and the bare bones of the story there were great material, because the story is really quite incredible.
So you didn't have to make it up. It was already there.
Well, that's the beauty of nonfiction. You know, you don't have to make it up, because the characters are fantastic. I mean, to give you your listeners a kind of an idea of the situation, you know, that these guys, Roger Mallinson and Roger Chapman, found themselves in. They were in a small Piacese submersible, and they eventually sank to 1,700 feet. So, but the way I always describe it to people is, try imagine you're in a phone box, a kind of relatively large phone box with your friend, and the phone box is sitting at the bottom of the Empire State Building, and you look out of the window and the Atlantic Ocean rolls in to a height 10 stories above the very top of the Empire State Building. Oh. Everything is pitch dark. Then you start bleeding oxygen. And then you realize that the people on the surface don't know exactly where you are, where you've sank. And when they do know where you are, either way, it's going to be 2 days at least before they can start the rescue. And then when they do start the rescue, everything goes wrong.
How did they get trapped in the first place? How did that happen?
Well, what happened was that they were doing a kind of standard job. This was 1973, and their job was to pilot the small commercial submersible, a Piacese 3. And what their job was this was back in 1973, when there was the Cantac cable, which was the Canadian transatlantic telephone cable, and it ran from Britain to Canada, and it had recently been laid, and this was high technology at the time. This allowed 1,700 phone calls to be made at any one time between North America and the UK. And I try and imagine that, you know, that was great. 1,700 phone calls could be made at any time.
Right.
Now, their job was, the cable had been laid, but their job was to bury it, because it was sitting on the surface, and at that depth, it could still have been hauled up by any kind of deep sea fishing trawlers. So their job was to dig a small trench and to let it drop into the trench. What happened was, they did an 8-hour shift. They went to the surface, and this is where it gets tragic for them and difficult to imagine today. At the time, the way that they tracked these submersibles, it was almost like Jaws, where they fired the arrow into the shark, and it was a barrel at the top. What happened was, there was a kind of large flotation device that was on the top of the surface, and it was connected to a cable to the submarine, and then 2,000 feet of rope, effectively. So that's how they knew where it was. So when it got to the surface, the diver disconnected this cable, so they no longer knew where it was, because it was on the surface. But then what happened was, there was a kind of a freak accident whereby a tow rope coiled onto the back of the submarine, and it accidentally lifted up a hatch. And what then happened was, a ton of water poured into the back of the submarine, and that obviously increased the weight of it, tipped it down, and it sank. First of all, it sank to 170 feet, where it was caught on a tow rope, and it managed to last on a tow rope for maybe 3 or 4 minutes, while they were frantically trying to sort of dump weight off the submarine. And then the tow rope snapped and the submarine fell another 1,500 feet, crash landed on the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean. And at that point, when they realized what happened, you know, they crash landed in the bottom, they knew they were deeper than any submarine had ever been rescued before. So they knew they both knew they were in serious trouble.
And so, explain the danger.
Well, the danger is twofold. One, you're in a steel coffin, effectively. You're in a submarine, but effectively it's a very tight space. You know, it's maybe 5 feet in diameter or less. You've also they don't know where you are on the surface. Because although you left the surface at a certain point, they don't know which direction they plummeted. They've also got a limited amount of oxygen supply. They've got roughly, if they were acting normally, they would have, moving around the submarine as they knew it, they would have 30 hours of oxygen left. Their job was now to lie very still, not to speak, and to be very calm. And by doing that, it was estimated they could stretch that oxygen out to maybe 3 days. The problem, though, was that in order for them to be rescued at that time when they crashed, the only way to rescue them was to get other submarines onto the spot, i.e. down to where they were. The only submarines that could do that, one was in the North Sea, one was in Canada, on the east coast of Canada, and the other one, which was fantastic, was in San Diego, where the CURV team operated from. Now, CURV was high technology in 1973. It was a remote-controlled submarine, a remote-controlled effective submarine device. And what happened then was that there was a massive rescue operation that was launched. They were stuck on the bottom of the Atlantic. And then phone calls were made to the teams in San Diego and the teams in Canada. And everything swung into action. Massive Hercules aircraft were prepared. The teams in San Diego and the teams in Halifax, Nova Scotia, got everything together, drove at speed to the airports, put all their equipment, men, submarines, every piece of technical, long ropes, and managed to get into the air as quickly as possible. So then they were flying over to Cork, where they landed. The ship that was on the surface then had to leave them after another ship had come to maintain the spot. The Vickers Voyager sailed 13 hours back to Cork, picked everyone up in Cork, got the submarines on board, then got them back to the rescue. And effectively what happened over a 25 to 36 hour period was a desperate rescue attempt, because they knew that every hour counted, every minute counted, every second counted. And these two men were running out of oxygen. And what they did was they sent down a mini submarine, first of all, to try and rescue them. The problem was the mini submarine had a rope gripped in its hand. They have these kind of talons, effectively. But the problem was the rope was too buoyant. So when it got down to about 1,000 feet, the buoyancy of the rope was too great and it ripped it out of the talon. So they don't have a rope to fix it with. They also don't know where it is. So the first mission ends in failure. The second mission goes down. The second submarine, which is the Canadians, go down. And they're down for 8 to 10 hours and they can't find it. As I've described it in the book, is they know where the haystack is. They know there's a haystack down there. They just don't know where the needle is. They just don't know where Pisces 3 is. They're trying to track it by sonar. So the first, second submarine's down for 10 hours, goes back to the surface, goes back down again. And what they try to do is they get the men to sing, to try and sing so that the higher notes they might be able to pick up on sonar. So they're singing, you know, we're here. And eventually they manage to find them. So there's this very moving scene where the two men in the submarine are looking out the porthole windows, because all they see is blackness and a tiny wash of crud, of bits of debris or animals that are floating past, the occasional fish. They can also hear dolphins and porpoises down there, and they interfere with the with the radio, the underwater telephone, as it's known. But there's an amazingly moving moment when the Canadians in their small mini submarine get closer and closer, and suddenly the light outside the submarine goes from pitch black and slowly begins to lighten and lighten and lighten. And that's when they realize they've been found.
Wow. What a story. And I'm trying to picture their response when they're asked to sing. And if the dolphins sang.
The thing was, it then just, again, although they've actually been found, the Canadians have to attach a hook to the kind of lift point in the submarine. And I've described it as like threading a needle while wearing a suit of armor. And they managed to do it. But the point is, again, another freak accident, no sooner is the rope with the hook attached than it rolls out and falls off. And they're scrambling to try and get the rope back on, but they can't get it on to the right point. They've connected it, but it's not to a point strong enough to lift it. And then they have to send down another sub. That doesn't work. And then the Americans, and again, there's a time's running out. So So what they do is they then, the Americans finally arrive on the scene, our boys from San Diego, you know, guys like Larry Brady, Jim McFarland. Sorry, that's the Canadians. Larry Brady was the Americans from San Diego. Bob Watts, Tom Wojcicki, Denny Holstein, John DeFriest, William Sanderson, and William Patterson. We've got, you're from San Diego, so I thought I'd mention all the local boys there.
Right.
But they are called in and they arrive on the scene. And again, things going wrong. They're told to power up Curve to send it down. And there's a massive electronic sort of system that powers this thing. And they switch it on because they're about to send it down. But what they don't know is that while they've been traveling out from Cork, salt water from the sea spray and the waves has got into the circuits. And literally, as soon as they flick it on, the whole thing blows. And we're at a time where every minute counts, they calculate it's going to be 4 hours for them to hand rewire all the circuit boards. And this is when everything is going wrong. But eventually the Americans get down, and after one team puts down a rope, the Americans get another one on. So it's just, yeah, it's to say that it was a roller coaster of a rescue, it does a dreadful disservice to roller coasters because it was far worse.
Right. And what was the state of the crew members?
Well, they were lucky in that Roger Mallinson, who is still alive, and I interviewed him extensively for the book, always said that he was so pleased that he was down with Roger Chapman, the Jolly Rogers, as they were known by the time they got back to shore, described by the British press. But Roger Chapman was ex-Navy, and he was a submariner, and had been on nuclear submarines before joining this commercial small submarine crew, Vickers. And Mallinson always said that he didn't think they would have survived if he'd been down with anyone else, because both of them were level-headed, and although they were terrified, they had that British stiff upper lip where they just suppressed it. They bit through the pain and frustration, but it was exceedingly difficult. A, try and imagine that stress where you're in there and oxygen's bleeding out because you're using oxygen. You've also got to operate the scrubber, which takes out carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, and that's dependent on the batteries, and the batteries could go at any minute. And they're also, because of as carbon dioxide rises in the atmosphere, you get splitting headaches and pain in your joints. And they're also worrying about their families.
Sure.
So it was, what was fascinating about the story was that they both said, Chapman in his memoir, which he'd written a couple of years after the events of 40 odd years ago, and Mallinson in interviews with me, they both said that the worst part of the whole experience was the lift, because it took them 2.5 hours to get from the bottom to the top. And because of the way that the waves were going and the ship they were attached to, they were like a giant fish attached to a rod, and the rod kept going up and down, so the submarine itself kept battering back and forth, so they were like sardines rattled in a very violent tin.
And that part, that being the worst part, are they talking about physically or emotionally or both?
I think it was two things. It was physically, because of the being battered about inside the submarine, and also the stress of it, because they didn't understand the device that was hooking them on. They thought it was a hook, like an open-ended hook. So in their head, all this shaking about meant they could fly off any second. And then it was the fact that they kept stopping. And at one point, other divers had to go down while this thing's thrashing about and fix a final line onto it. So it's a remarkable story. But for me, it's a remarkable story in that it's about the brotherhood of the sea. You know, this notion that if you are in peril in the sea, all other ships will come to your aid. Everything's put on hold. And the priority is, how do we get these men up? So we had the Canadians, you know, the amazing team from Heiko coming over, like, you know, Al Trice, Mike McDonald, Jim McBeth. They all fly over. You've got the San Diego team that I've talked about, and you've also got their own team from Vickers Voyager. It's a remarkable story.
The determination.
Yeah, I think it teaches you. There's a great quote I've always loved from Winston Churchill, where he said, "Never, ever, ever give in," And I think it's very true. And that's certainly what they did. Peter Messervy, who was a kind of former commander who led the rescue along with Al Trice, it was tenacity. And it was, Al Trice always used to joke, if it was easy, everyone would be doing it.
Right.
Now, he said that when he was looking at the helicopter that was supposed to bring them rope from another ship, and the helicopter had misjudged the weight of the rope. So the helicopter took off with this basket carrying all this rope underneath it. And literally, as soon as it took off, it started plummeting down towards the sea because it was dragged down by the rope, and it had to jettison the rope or else it would have crashed. So suddenly this rope they need is bobbing about on the surface of the North Sea in the midst of a storm. So that was just another thing that went wrong.
My goodness. How do you think you would respond if you were to find yourself in this kind of situation?
Yeah, I'm not sure I would have coped as well as either Chapman or Mallinson. I think we claustrophobia would have been...
That's what I was thinking, yes.
It would have been excruciating. And also that sense of panic, that also... the way your mind operates in these situations where you're constantly projecting about all the things that could go wrong, everything that had gone wrong, but then all the things that still could go wrong. So I think, if you want to imagine what it'd be like, just imagine yourself in that telephone box at the bottom of the Empire State Building and then the Atlantic Ocean rolling in. I think it would have been, it would have been hard to say the least.
I can't help thinking a discipline of mind.
Well, I suppose the other thing is we never know what we're capable of until we're in that situation.
That's true.
But the key is not to be in a small submarine that sinks.
Right. What was it like to research this book for you?
The fascinating thing about it was I had my plan. Again, there's a great line I always love, which applies to this rescue operation as applied to the writing of the book, because there's a good, the phrase, how do you make God laugh? Tell him your plans. And of course, my plan was to travel over to San Diego to meet the guys, travel to Canada to interview them, to go down to the Lake District to meet Roger Mallinson and Roger Chapman's wife and widow. But of course, the pandemic kicked in and no one was going anywhere. So the entire book was conducted, all the research was done from my house, interviewing people over the phone, over Zoom, just getting documents that I could, the original. What was great is a lot of it was based on paperwork, so it was the original report into the crash. Mm-hmm. I got access to that. Also, the teams in Canada and in America had written their own documents about it, so I was able to use a lot of those material, and also found old recordings. So in a project like this, it's all about stitching the material together. You have your facts, you know the circumstance. I've always believed in three C's when it comes to projects like this. It's all about character, context, and chronology. And if you can get those three elements and lay them out and then think, how do I tell this in a way that's absolutely factually correct to the best of your ability? But will engage the reader as much as possible. How can I put the reader in the experiences of these men? It was a great story to write, and also because it's got such a happy ending. I hope that even though people will read from the blurb that they survived, that when you're in the midst of it, you forget.
Right.
Because that was the, I think the reason what one of the things I wanted to push people into it was to write a lot of it in the present tense, because we know these guys didn't know that they were going to pull off this rescue. Messervy at 3 o'clock on Saturday morning, when he knew he didn't yet have a lift line on the submarine and they had 6 hours of oxygen left. He'd been at it for 26 hours and they hadn't got a line on it. Obviously we know that he pulled it off, but to be in that position and he's just got a phone call from the other ship from the Americans, we're just about to send the curve down, but it's blown its fuses. There's going to be a 3 or 4 hour delay. Yeah, these are very tough situations. Yeah,
it's like dying any minute for hours.
Yeah, I mean, that's what they were doing. They were dying down there. and they managed to get them back. In fact, that was the touching thing, because again, all these are all hardy men of the sea and you know, white blue collar workers pulling together from around the world to save them. And I think it is telling that when they finally got to the surface, on the ships around them, a lot of the guys who'd been working on it were at the railings watching. And as soon as it hit the surface, people talked about how they just burst into tears.
It's a wonderful ending. One last question, kind of apart from this particular amazing story, what after this, what book or documentary are you going to work on next?
Yeah, well, I've got a new idea for a book, which I can't kind of go into all the details yet.
Okay.
To what it is, but I'm developing that. It's again, the plan is it'll be a nonfiction thriller. You know, basically, obviously, I write factual books. That's my kind of forte. But the other project that we're obviously keen to do is we're developing. The Dive has been optioned by Mark Gordon, the producer of Saving Private Ryan and Speed, and we're developing it now.
Wow.
With a great team to develop it as a film. So
yes.
I'm looking forward to helping out with that and to seeing how that all comes out.
Yes, that would be a wonderful film. Well, Stephen McGinty, thank you so much for joining us. It was a pleasure having you on Bookshelf and hearing all about your adventure, vicarious adventure.
Yes, indeed. Tales of the Sea.
So thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
For further information on Stephen McGinty and his book, The Dive, please visit him on Twitter at SG McGinty, and that's spelled SGMCGINTY. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for our region.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia, and the Smashing Beats. Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine Radio Show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.